Okay, so we will start with the homage. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So today is July 25th, 2015. Okay, good morning, everybody. And so we have been discussing sutta number 135 in the Middle Eighth Discourses. This is the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutta, the shorter exposition of action. And the word translated action is actually the Pali word kama, same as the Sanskrit karma. So it's not just the innocent word action, but it's action in a special sense of, call this, morally significant volitional action. And action here is conceived against the backdrop of the Buddhist understanding of volitional action as being a kind of, call it a moral force or even a cosmic force, which determines our personal destiny. So according to the law of karma, whatever morally significant volitional deeds we perform, whether wholesome or unwholesome, good or bad, whether bodily, verbal, or purely mental, those deeds do not just disappear once the action is completed, but those deeds, we could say that they deposit a seed within the stream of the mind, or they create a certain potential within the mind, but a potential which is not merely psychological, but this karmic force that is generated is connected to a much, much wider, call it a global network of conditionality, such that these volitional actions, the karma created by the volitional actions, has a potential to come back to us in a way that corresponds to the ethical quality of the original action. So that the results that we experience as the effects of our willed actions reflect the moral quality of the original action. And of course, the basic principle, the most general principle, is that good deeds or wholesome deeds will come back to us in the form of beneficial results, fortunate results, whereas unwholesome deeds come back to us in the form of painful results, in the form of misfortune, deprivation, suffering. So that is the general working of the law of karma. And now this principle of karma is to be explained in this particular sutta in response to the question that was posed by the young Brahmin student named Subha. So he approached the Buddha and then he asked them, what is the cause and condition why human beings are seen to be inferior and superior And then expressing this more elaborately, he says, why are they seen to be short-lived and long-lived, sickly and healthy, ugly and beautiful, uninfluential or powerless, and influential or powerful, poor and wealthy, low-born and high-born, stupid and wise, foolish and wise? And so when he's asked that question, the Buddha first replies with a general statement, a brief statement. He says that living beings are the owners of their karma, the heirs of their karma. They originate from their karma. They are bound to their karma. They have karma as their refuge or resort. And it is their karma that distinguishes them as inferior and superior. Then when Supa says that he doesn't understand the meaning of this brief statement, then the Buddha offers to elaborate for him. And then he explains the first distinction is that between beings who are short-lived and long-lived. And so the Buddha explains this on the basis of, or he explains that those beings are short-lived because they have been killers of other living beings. So they've been devoted to a life of violence, merciless, and they've deprived other living beings of their life. And so all unwholesome deeds, their natural propensity is to, if they are to take on the role of generating rebirth, their propensity is to produce rebirth in the lower realms of existence. That is, in what is called the dukkati, the bad destinations. Okay, so as I explained last week, that karmic actions have different functions. And so one of the functions is called the productive function. That's the function by which the deed produces rebirth. And so if that unwholesome deed of killing takes on the role of generating rebirth, then it will produce a rebirth into the bad destinations. The bad destinations, the lowest are the hell realms, then comes the realm of the animals, then the realm of the pretas, or the afflicted spirits. And so in its productive function, the bad deed produces the rebirth in a bad destination. But the bad deeds also have another function, which is called an obstructive function. And so if the bad deed takes on the obstructive function, then If the person has been reborn in a good destination, say as a human being, then that being will meet a lot of trouble and difficulty and hardships in the course of their life. And then the bad deed has still another function, which is called the destructive function. And if the bad deed of killing takes on the destructive function, then the person might be reborn in the happy destination as a human being, but because of the destructive function, when that karma matures, it will cut off the lifespan prematurely. And so we have the case where somebody might be living in good health, happiness, everything is going smoothly with that person, but then maybe a sudden accident, the person is caught in a sudden accident, automobile collision, or they might be, you know, walking innocently. Maybe we read sometimes people sitting in a restaurant and then a madman comes in with a gun and starts shooting. I mean, part of the fault is the gun policy, the crazy gun policy in this country. But the karmic factor underlying that, one would say, is that there is a latent destructive karma, a destructive karma lying latent in that person's stream of consciousness. And now that latent karma has gained the opportunity to ripen that latent destructive karma. And so, you know, there might be the restaurant of 70 people sitting there, and the gunman comes in and starts shooting, and maybe 3 people die. So why do 3 people die out of 70? So the explanation from a Buddhist point of view, at least the possible explanation, would be that there have been, in those people, they have had the tendencies, they have had a destructive karma seeking the opportunity to come to fruition. And that is what accounts for these sudden, otherwise abnormal deaths. Okay, then we have the opposite case, which is that of a person who abandons the killing of living beings and abstains from killing living beings. Somebody who has given up violence and makes the determination to be kind to others and to act towards others with loving kindness and compassion. And so this is creating wholesome or virtuous karma. And if that karma takes on the function of, the productive function of generating rebirth, since it's a good karma, it will produce rebirth in one of the suggatis, the good destination. And here the sutta speaks about the case, what would be the strongest case, that is the case where the karma takes on the role of generating rebirth in a heavenly realm. But then it says that if instead that person comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is long lived. So the good karma of abstaining from killing produces rebirth. As a good karma, it produces rebirth in the human state. Human rebirth, according to Buddhism, is always the result of a wholesome karma. But not only does it produce rebirth in the human state, but because this is the karma of avoiding the destruction of life, when it produces rebirth in the human realm, then it will produce a rebirth which is of one who is long-lived, who enjoys a long lifespan. So then the Buddha wraps up that section and he says, this is the way that leads to long life, namely abandoning the killing of living beings when abstains from killing living beings, and so on. Okay, so that is what we covered last week. Okay, now we come to the next section. Okay, a lot of this is similar, you know, parallel to what we covered, what's covered in the basic pair, but the differences lie in the details. So here we have the case of a man or woman who is disposed in the habit of injuring beings with a clod, with a stick, with a knife. Those were the weapons that were available to people in ancient India. Okay, so again, if that karma takes on the role of generating rebirth, then it will bring a rebirth in one of the bad destinations. Probably the destination, the realm of rebirth, will not be as grave, and the torment will not be as severe as that of killing living beings. Since killing takes away that which is most valuable, which is what? One's life. But maybe if one is disposed to injuring living beings, then when one gets reborn, then one might be reborn, possibly if the motivation is bad enough, with a lot of hatred and ill will and cruelty, it might bring a rebirth in the hells, but otherwise it could bring rebirth, say, in the animal realm, where you get reborn as an ill-treated ox. You know, if you've ever seen an ox, it has to carry a heavy load, and then the owner is behind it, beating it with a whip. What are some other animals that have to undergo? Wow, I mean, there's just, the animals undergo so much torment and affliction in this country. You've maybe taken as a dog or a cat used for chemical tests to make cosmetics or for testing the effects of various chemicals. Okay, but if a person comes back to the human state, if that person comes back to the human state, then the rebirth itself is determined by what kind of productive karma. Good or bad? Right, it's a wholesome karma.
Liz. I don't get it. I mean, there's bad people born as human beings and good people born as human, productive.
Okay, hold that point. It's an interesting point, hold it.
I can't.
You have to learn. No, I'm not taking questions yet. Okay, but the karma that determines the rebirth is a good karma. But now, the unwholesome karma that has been created doesn't go away. But that karma can mature in a different way, not through the productive function, but it will take on the obstructive function. And so though the person is reborn as a human being through the good karma, but this person, through the maturing of the obstructive karma, they'll meet a lot of trouble and difficulty, especially difficulty regarding health. So if that person comes back to the human state, then wherever he or she is reborn, that person will be sickly. disposed to fall ill very often, have different kinds of health afflictions, even from childhood. Okay, so this is the way that leads to sickliness. Namely, one is given to injuring beings with a hand, with a clod, with a stick, with a knife, or with other means of affliction. And now, this seems to me to be a point that's not clear from the sutta itself, but what I would say is that when a person is sickly and meets also with a lot of injuries and affliction at the hands of others, it can come about through the maturing either of the karma of taking life or the karma of injuring living beings. Both those types of karma can take on the obstructive role, and they'll produce pain, affliction, and misery for the person. Perhaps if the person is chronically ill, that is the result of injuring living beings. If the person undergoes a lot of injuries rather than illness, subjected to a lot of physical force and physical violence, that would be the result of the maturation in the obstructive role of the karma of taking life. But that's my personal opinion. Okay, then we have the contrary case. Here, some man or woman is not given to injuring beings with the hand, with the clod, with the stick, and so forth. Okay, because of performing and undertaking such action, under dissolution of the body after death, he is reborn in a happy destination. Okay, now this, I think, I'm not sure that I clarified this last week. So we speak here about somebody who is not injuring beings in various ways. So how does it come about that one is not deliberately injuring beings? You know, we can think, or we could say that, okay, a person just doesn't have the opportunity to injure beings. And so, you know, if a person in a situation where they don't encounter beings less fortunate than themselves or more vulnerable than themselves, then they're not injuring those beings. And so can we say that, therefore they are accumulating good karma? No. But rather, we make a distinction of three ways in which one is refraining from injuring and harming living beings. Okay, one way is called refraining when one encounters the opportunity. That is, one finds oneself in a situation, maybe for example, we have a teenage kid and you know, a group of guys have gathered around a particularly vulnerable kid in the school, and they're teasing him, and as they're teasing him, they get worked up even more, and then they start punching him and beating him. And there's one kid in the group who, when he sees this going on, thinks, that's not right. And so he refrains. Maybe he tries to dissuade the others without success. But while the others are beating up the unfortunate kid, this one is refraining. Even though there's the opportunity, you know, everybody else is doing it, why isn't he doing it? Or maybe somebody is working in a laboratory where they are testing chemicals on animals, and he sees that this is his job and it's his responsibility to do this too, And so he makes a decision. He says, I can't do this. This is too cruel. I'm going to give up this job and find another job where I don't have to afflict animals. Okay, so this is called refraining in situations where one encounters the opportunity. In this case, the opportunity, sometimes even the obligation to inflict injury on others. Okay, the second case, or the second way in which one refrains from injuring living beings, this is when one undertakes a precept or undertakes the training rule. So in this case, one makes the determination. Usually refraining from injuring living beings will be subsumed under the precept to abstain from the destruction of life. So when one takes the precept, panati pata viramani, sikapadang samadhiyami, then one is directing one's will, making a firm determination even before any opportunity is encountered to transgress. And by making that determination, then one knows that even if one, whether one encounters that opportunity or not, one is not going to injure living beings. So for most of us, as we're following the Buddha's path, this is the way in which we refrain from injuring others, by undertaking the precept, the training rule, and so we are directing our minds along the track of the precept. And so the precept itself, undertaking the precept itself, sets up a powerful condition that will block one from any kind of transgressive action. Okay, the third way in which one refrains from injuring living beings is when one cuts off permanently the defilement that is responsible for violence against others. In this case, I think it would probably be with the achievement, the cutting off of the tendency to killing living beings takes place, I believe, with the attainment of stream entry. And so the stream enterer is one who observes the five precepts inviolably. And I would assume that under that also the stream enterer is one who just by his very nature will not inflict harm and injury on other living beings. Okay, maybe I'll ask whether there are any questions at this point. Victor,
First, Bhante, can you really explain cosmic force? Where does the decision get made if we're going to get God out of the picture?
Yeah. Let me use it as an analogy. I don't know if you will accept it, but if I throw a rubber ball against that wall at this angle, who is it that determines that the ball is going to bounce off that wall in that direction? What is that?
You do.
No.
You know that if you hit a ball here, it's going to go there.
No, I don't determine that it's going to go there. I determine which way I'm going to throw the ball. But the way the ball will bounce after it hits the wall is determined by any physicist here.
Newton called it laws of motion.
Yeah, it's a law of motion. Okay, who makes the law? The laws of motion? you know, a theist, of course, will say God makes the laws of motion, but there are, you know, millions of scientists who are non-theists, who are atheists. They accept the laws of motion without accepting a God who imposes the law and regulates events according to the law. And so in the same way, there is, according to the Buddhist teaching, there is this principle of karma according to which actions produce results that correspond to the nature of the action. And that is just, it's as fixed a law of it's fixed the cosmic law as the laws of motion.
Thank you so much. One more thing. Actually, I have five, but
no,
just one. If you're born with wholesome karma,
yeah,
and then,
yeah,
why would you kill?
Why what?
You're born with wholesome karma.
Yeah.
You come from wholesome karma.
Yeah.
You didn't kill, you did all the right things, you came back.
Yeah.
Why would you then kill?
I would say that there are, though the human being is, the person of being is reborn into the human realm as a result of wholesome karma, but there are many defilements which have been lying in the mind, you know, through time without beginning. Yeah. And many habitual tendencies which have been planted in the mind, established in the mind. And so one has these habitual tendencies. We have both the presently, the defilements inherited through the beginningless past, the presently activated defilements which can be aroused by personal upbringing, by social conditions, economic conditions, and there are one's own habitual tendencies which are brought over from previous lives. And so all of these together can dispose a person to kill and to injure others, even though they have reborn in the human realm as a result of the wholesome karma.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah. But
Thank
there
you.
Are some problems which I'll bring up when we come to a later session.
There are
some problems. Yeah. So I'm not going to let the Buddha get off so easily. Or myself get off so easily.
Bhante, you said if you throw the ball against the wall, it's going to bounce in a certain way.
Yeah.
But don't you know that if you throw the ball at a certain angle, it's going to bounce?
Well, maybe if I throw it, but let's suppose...
Let me just add one thing. If you fire a gun into a crowd, don't you know that you're going to... I mean, yes, I'm not aiming at anybody. But it's the same thing. If you fire a gun, don't you know that there's a consequence? Or it's going... A certain action is going to happen, or reaction, should I say, on your action, based on your action?
I'm not quite sure I get the point. When one shoots a gun into a crowd, of course one knows that there's a high probability that you're going to kill people. You don't know that the act of killing is going to produce a karmic force that's going to result in suffering either later in this life or in a future life. That one doesn't know. Okay, that's the problem of the person throwing the ball against the wall, if you find that problematic. How about there's a dead tree in the woods and the wind blows at a particular velocity? What is it that determines that the tree, when the wind reaches a particular... When the tree dries out to a certain extent and the wind reaches a certain velocity and the roots are weakened to a certain extent, what is it that determines that the tree will fall on this day at this moment rather than on other days at other moments? It's just the laws of physics. Victor had his hand up at the beginning. So.
Yes, I remember last week you said that karma is intention.
Yeah.
So these suttas discuss, or this particular sutta discusses the killing or harming with the intention to kill or harm.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there was any sutta that discussed what, if you had to kill, for example, to save others, whereas your intention was to save, like self-defense, or even though you killed a person, you had a good intention.
You know, it's an interesting point, because there are no, this has been something frustrating for me as well, that I haven't encountered the problem in real life, but just on a theoretical level, that one doesn't find in the suttas situations where there is what we would call a conflict of moral obligations. And so this would raise, you know, problems. What does one do when there is a conflict of moral obligations? For example, let us take the case, a policeman comes on the scene, there's a madman who's some distance away so that he can't just shoot to injure. A madman has come into a schoolyard and he's shooting its students. And already maybe the madman has killed several students and he's starting, continuing to shoot. So the policeman, I would say that it's his obligation to protect the public, he has to kill. And so the intention is quite different from that of somebody who with a malicious intent, you know, will take the lives of others.
But it still creates some karma.
Excuse me?
It still creates some karma on the karma.
It's an interesting question. Does he create unwholesome karma? You know, if one just takes the text on the surface, you would have to say, yes, but the unwholesome karma is mitigated by the fact that the intention is to protect the lives of innocent people. But then couldn't one say that the intention of protecting the lives of innocent people creates a wholesome karma? You know, these are things, the complexity, I don't have the answers to them. In the back, please. Your name?
So, if I understand this, and you can correct me, Matthew, if the outer world is a projection of my inner world,
projection? I don't know that I would use that idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if I am shooting at somebody, is it, in a sense, I'm kind of shooting at myself, in a sense?
Well, first, I wouldn't say that the outer world is a projection of the inner world. But things that occur in the outer world can reflect or can be the consequences of our karma, of our previous actions. And if we shoot somebody, I wouldn't say that you're shooting yourself. I wouldn't take that literally, but if one shoots somebody, one is creating a karma which can mature at some future time in the form of somebody shooting at you and then taking your life. Whether that occurs in this life itself, or more likely in some future life. Okay. Since we're close to Debbie, you take Debbie, Ravi, and Chris. Then we have to go on. Because there are some interesting sections, problematic sections to come.
Many animals must kill to survive.
Yeah.
Is that the intention to kill considered a volitional act that would be interpreted as karma?
Yeah, I would say definitely that's the case. But what I would say, the case of animals, when they are killing, even to survive, they are committing the act of killing, and it's an unwholesome intention. And it's creating unwholesome karma. But I say that in the case of animals, because the killing is sort of embedded within their biological program, it's quite different from that of the killing by human beings who are not obliged to kill by their very nature. And so in an animal killing, the intention is not vicious, not malicious. But because killing is so widespread in the animal realm, this is why it's said that once a being falls into the animal realm, it becomes very difficult to get out of it. Though there are animals that, for the most part, don't kill. And even there are cases where animals save lives, like very loyal dogs who sometimes even will risk their own life to save a member of the family.
Monty, while we're on the topic of killing, that's a very extreme situation. Based on that, all of us are generating great karma because we're not killing
him. I'm not hearing. But that's... You're going out of turn. I think. Did I send you?
Yeah.
I sent you. Oh, okay.
But this, since killing is a very extreme situation,
yeah.
A lot of us don't indulge in killing.
Yeah.
What, in your view, is a comparable, you know, action in this lifetime which generates bad karma or as bad karma? I mean, by law or just by general evolution, I think there'd be about 75-80% of us who never indulge in something as extreme as killing someone or something.
I didn't quite get the question.
If bad karma of this extent is only generated by killing or taking a life,
yeah,
and the majority of us do not indulge in an action like that,
yeah,
do you believe that we are just progressing towards a better lifetime? Or, you know, it's a little unrealistic to think a lot of us could be killing.
Yeah, but don't forget that there are many other types of unwholesome actions besides killing.
Right.
So unwholesome actions are creating unwholesome karma, and unwholesome karma has the tendency to bring a lower rebirth.
So it's not just killing, but it could be other...
Oh, yeah, yeah, there are many, there are, you know, there are,
right.
Last week I think I spoke about the ten paradigmatic, or the paradigm of unwholesome karma, with 10 types of unwholesome action. We had Robbie next, then Chris.
Thank you, Bhante. Bhante, when it comes to these scientific things, one must be very careful because the laws, Newton's laws of motion were considered the last word in science at that time.
So,
Newton's laws of motion were considered the last word in science,
yeah, yeah,
200 years ago.
Yeah.
But today they find that those laws don't hold when it comes to subatomic.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So, for me, as far as I'm concerned, I consider it all as part of nature, and I don't worry about that part.
Yeah.
Because, on the other hand, with reference to karma, to me, it's a very simple thing. If you do something good automatically, good will follow.
Yeah.
As I said in the Dhamma Pada, if you do something bad.
Yeah.
And this concept is there,
yeah,
in most religions,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they say, in the Bible, they say, you reap what you sow.
Yeah.
Essentially, this is also karma.
Yeah.
You do good, you do good, go to heaven, or go to hell, you,
yeah,
do bad. And this concept of karma is only an extension of this same thing.
Yeah.
Go to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
That it could happen, during, the results can come even during this life.
Yeah.
Or in,
yeah,
the future.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, very simple.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, Chris, then if Richard has a simple question, I'll take it. No, I'm serious, because we have to finish the sutra today.
What about aiding and abetting or assisting in killing?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
If you pay your taxes, builds the military, government kills people, what about if you, you know, in failing to protest? You know, that you allow your money to be spent that way.
No, that's a big topic for a discussion. I don't have the time. I want to cover the basic principles of the sutta, not to get into, you know, the intricate ethical questions that arise, but just the one point that you brought up when you first phrased the question. Sometimes what is said is, under each of the karmic actions, that there are sort of three aspects. One is directly performing the action oneself. The second is by commissioning somebody else to perform it on one's behalf. So I don't want, you know, I'm the big bank, I call this the bank robber, but I don't go to the bank myself in order to pull a gun on the tellers. But I got my guys, my goons.
We're always told, this is that the government acts in our name. The world saying that it's acting in our name.
I mean, this brings up sort of, you know, subtle matters of, you know, ethical reflection. Right now, I'm just trying to...
Well, let me just ask one quick question.
I didn't finish the three aspects related to each of the ethical principles. So one is directly personally performing the action. The second is commissioning or encouraging somebody else to perform it. And the third is approving of or rejoicing in the action once it's been done. Okay. So those are the three aspects. Okay, we'll take Chris. Then, I'm sorry, you have to hold the question.
Bhante, are we talking about just the action itself or the thought? Because many times, like what I think Debbie was saying, many people may not actually carry it out, and that would be the action. But many people might think of killing somebody and not carry it out, or wish another one harm.
Okay. That is another matter. Having the thought, the intention, the wish is creating unwholesome karma, but it's not tantamount to the act of actually killing somebody. So it creates unwholesome karma, but the unwholesome karma probably will not be as grave as that of actually completing the act of killing, executing the act of killing. Okay, let us move on. Okay, here we have somebody who is angry, irritable. This is sort of a stock sutta description of the angry person. So even when criticized a little, they get offended, they become angry, hostile and resentful. Okay, because of performing such actions, they are reborn in a state of deprivation. That's a bad destination. Okay, I mean, I think if somebody maybe becomes really habitually violent in character and very full of anger, that can happen. It seems to me a bit dubious that it will happen with just somebody who, in the normal course of events, gets angry and displeased. Okay, but if instead that person comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is ugly. So this is the way that leads to ugliness, namely one is angry and of an irritable character. Okay, then the opposite of this, I'm going to go quickly through some of the less problematic sections. Well, there's also, I could see some problems here, which I'll bring up after I go through the counterpart section. Okay, so here we have somebody who is not angry and irritable. Even when they're criticized a lot, they don't become angry. Okay, and because of performing such actions, that is, because of exercising this restraint over anger and not becoming angry, they're reborn in a happy destination, the heavenly world. But if that person comes back to the human state, then wherever he or she is reborn, they are beautiful. So this is the way that leads to being beautiful, namely one is, let's put it in a positive way, one is patient, forbearing, soft and gentle of character, and does not display anger, hate, and bitterness. And one could see how this can be almost an extrapolation from the facial expression that appears that on us in response as a reflection of our moods. So when somebody gets angry, then the scowl appears on the face, the muscles tighten, and one has an ugly expression. Whereas if somebody is patient and forbearing, then the face looks calm, benign, gentle. And so that you could see how that would be projected onto future lives, that as a human being one will become one will have an ugly expression. If one is patient, then one will have become beautiful. But one reason why I could see this as a bit problematic is that I know people who from a worldly point of view would say that they're ugly, but they're very kind, considerate, compassionate, patient. And other people who, again in worldly terms, would say, ah, they're beautiful, they're maybe movie stars, well, I don't know women who win beauty contests. I don't know any personally. But I can imagine that they get angry and irritated very easily. So well, how do we make this out? Doesn't it seem like a contradiction?
Could it just be from a past life? Maybe their current life they're angry, but sometime in the past they're patient somehow.
Okay, so this is the explanation in terms of the difference between the past life, say, character traits, and the present life character traits. Somebody else?
The same question I was thinking.
Are you going to say the same thing? Okay, so that might be a way to understand it. So I would think that past life character traits, habitual dispositions would tend to be transmitted from one life to the next, so that if one forms a disposition of being patient and forbearing in an earlier life, then in this life one will have that tendency to be patient. But one could still see that there are these underlying tendencies towards anger, ill will, which if they're provoked by environmental conditions, family upbringing, economic conditions, or any series of experiences, it will exacerbate those tendencies and then activate them so that they manifest in the form of a disposition to anger and ill will. Okay, let's go on to... Okay, the next one is... somebody, man or woman, who is envious, who envies, resents, and begrudges the gains, honor, respect, reverence, salutations, and veneration of others. Okay, so again, this envy, if it takes on the rebirth-generating role, it's a rebirth into bad destinations. But if instead that person comes back to the human state, then wherever he or she is reborn, he is uninfluential or without power to influence events. So this is the way that leads to being uninfluential, that one is envious towards the gains, honor, and reverence of others. Okay, then we have the opposite case. Somebody is not envious. They don't envy, resent, and begrudge the gains, honors of others. But instead, he comes back to the human state, and wherever he is reborn, he is influential or powerful. Who would we say have been some powerful people? Let's take the 20th century. Influential, powerful people.
President of the U.S.
No. I would say Bhikkhu Bodhi.
No. I'm not.
I don't think
has gone that extreme. Could be within a family member or a community. A person could be looked up as a parent. I mean, somebody. I mean, big. I mean, you don't have to be that big in order to be noted by people. I mean, I don't think so. Mm. There are many great human beings that are not famous.
Pete Seeger?
Jane?
Pete Seeger would be influential.
Excuse me?
Pete Seeger, he cleaned up the Hudson River.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Ralph Nader?
I'm trying to get some controversial cases.
The Koch brothers.
Martin Luther King.
That's what I had that in mind, yeah.
Martin Luther King.
I want to get some people on the opposite side of the spectrum. Maybe we take both sides. Okay, we call it people who have been influential for positive development. So we've had Pete Seeger, Ralph Nader, though he's always been snubbed by those in power, you know, so he always has to struggle and fight, doesn't make it. Martin Luther King. Then we have the negative sides of the Koch brothers.
Chairman Mao.
Yeah. Very influential, very powerful. How long did he live? What was his age?
Too long.
But he lived to his 80s, right?
75, I think.
75? It's okay, a fairly long lifespan. So it's not, you know, you could say Adolf Hitler, but Adolf Hitler, you know, was cut off. And
Strom Thurmond.
He lived to be what? To be, he got to be 100.
Yeah, 100. Yeah,
100. Wow. Strom Thurmond. Yeah. Joseph Stalin.
For sure.
How old was?
He was around 80 also.
Yeah, so you know, it's not the case that they get cut off early in life. Not like Hitler and Mussolini. So they have long lifespans. They're very powerful and influential. They get everything goes their way pretty much.
So maybe they didn't kill anybody in the last
year. Chairman Mao lived a long time. He lived to 82.
82, yeah.
Wow.
I thought that he was in his 80s. So they were very influential. This is not the lifespan. I'm just getting the lifespan so we don't have those.
The lifespan is part of good.
Yeah, the lifespan is part of good, but that's a different type of karma.
Oh.
But can we imagine that the Koch brothers, Joseph Stalin, Chairman Mao, in previous life, didn't envy and begrudge?
They had underlying influences. I've got it.
When they had to knock off in this life, they had to knock off competitors to get into that powerful position. Yeah, that's a good point. You're wrong.
I can't say I grew up as a Buddhist, but we've been through a lot of Buddhist classes. I kind of feel that we're taking the wrong path with this type of discussion because I've always been taught that. With karma, you don't focus on the consequences and trying to trace back and trying to see what did they do to get here. Instead of looking into the future, if I do something now, it will lead to something in the future.
Yeah.
And in the Mahayana path, we were always told that only the fools will pay attention to the consequences we're receiving. The bodhisattvas pay attention to the causes we're creating right now.
Yeah.
So I am very serious about this. I feel that we're going down the wrong path with our American friends here.
In fact,
if you do that, you'll go crazy. Because for example, like currently at work, I'm working very, very hard, getting no pay, because we feel that there are certain things we need to turn around for the good of the majority, while there are people, our colleagues, doing nothing, getting more pay and getting better reputation.
Yeah.
And if you keep digging in terms of karma, all I can say is that they have better karmas in the past, either that or creating bad karmas now.
Yeah.
I don't want to compare my karma with theirs, otherwise I go crazy.
Yeah. Okay, okay, you've said enough. That's actually a very, very good point. And I often, I mean, in this class itself, when I've been asked questions about karma, I always say that I don't, and my advice is not to, that we don't try to start from what we're experiencing in the present and then say, ah, this must be the result of some karma in the past, and then trace a present experience back to the past and say, therefore we must have done such and such deeds. But rather, I always say that we should look at karma from the standpoint of the cause proceeding forward to the effect. But the sutta itself, in a way, sets itself up for this kind of... I have to say, it does. Yeah. It does set itself up for that kind of analysis. Anyway, let us continue. Okay, so now we have somebody... Now I'm in section 13. So this is going to be the pair of... The consequences is poverty and wealth. And so we have the man or woman who does not give food, drink, all the items that one would give to recluses and Brahmins back in ancient India. And so because of performing and undertaking such action, in a sense, withholding things, having a miserly attitude, not being willing to give, that is considered in itself an action, a karma. So because they're performing and undertaking such action, that person reappears, is reborn in a bad destination. But if instead they come back to the human state, then wherever they are reborn, they are poor. So it says, this is the way, student, that leads to poverty. Namely, one doesn't give food and so forth to ascetics and Brahmins. And then what is the way that leads? Now we take the converse case. So here we have the man or woman who gives all of these items to ascetics and Brahmins. And because of performing and undertaking such wholesome action, they are reborn in a happy destination. But if they come back to the human state, then wherever they are reborn, they are wealthy. So that is the way, student, that leads to wealth, namely giving food, so forth, to ascetics and Brahmins. In a sense, I have to say that if this is the way that leads to wealth, doesn't it imply that if somebody is wealthy, we can trace their wealth, their prosperity, back to giving?
Okay, I keep wondering that this lifetime is also an opportunity, not just for the expression of karma. You know, we are even given an opportunity to realize ourselves in this lifetime. So we can't just take a one-dimensional view of karma and think that whatever we are going to is a result of our past karma. So we may have wealth, but that's an opportunity for us to be generous and generate good karma. It may necessarily not have to do with our past life. It may just be, you know...
Yeah, in fact, there are like other suttas which speak about the causes for acquiring wealth, and those suttas don't even mention past karma. They say that if a person wants to acquire wealth, they should be energetic, diligent, make an effort and apply themselves skillfully to their business, their enterprise. Wait, let me just think of the sutta. Alavaka Sutta. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 10. Sutta number 10, I think.
We have 7 billion people on the planet, and 3 billion of those are living in the poverty level, and another probably 2 billion or more are barely getting by.
Yeah.
How do we explain that? I mean, as far as, is everybody a miser, you know?
Yeah, that's why I find some of this problematic. I would say that there are, you know, social conditions, economic conditions that cause and maintain poverty. And it's pretty hard to say that everybody who's living in poverty is in that condition because in previous lives they didn't give gifts to ascetics and Brahmins. And also I find it hard to believe that, this is again what I find problematic, say the super rich people, I mean there are a few good ones, but a lot of them are very miserly and even do very unscrupulous things to enhance their wealth. The Koch brothers.
At the detriment of others.
Yeah. And yet I would think that they didn't, if they had been generous in a previous lives, that generous tendency would have carried through into the present, is that they would have been, had the tendency to be generous in this life. But there's just so many details in the workings of karma that, you know, I can't answer all these questions.
But acquiring good karma doesn't take you to Nibbana either.
Yeah, but this is, the sutta is not concerned with the way to Nibbana, but the way to good. The question is, what is it that distinguishes beings as fortunate and unfortunate?
No, I was going to say that
I was going to make a comment that we were saying, I mean, if let's say a child is born into a really wealthy family, it might be because in the previous life, you know, he was very generous. But now in this current family, although he's wealthy, in his current family, maybe his current family raised him to be more miserly, you know, and so now that tendency kind of being generous suddenly, like, kind of like, not brainwashed, but just raised to be more miserly by his wealthy family. I don't know. Maybe that's why it changes.
Yeah, there's an interplay between present, past tendencies and present conditions.
Right.
And probably very often the present conditions can overwhelm and overpower the past tendencies.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I want to move on. I lost the place. 14. Okay, so we finished 14. Okay, now we have a man or a woman who is obstinate and arrogant, who does not pay homage to one who should receive homage and so on, who does not revere and venerate those who should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. And we have to remember that this is being taught or spoken in the Indian cultural context where there were especially the ascetics and the renunciants who would be traditionally given honor and veneration. Okay, so because of, you know, withholding this honor and veneration to those who should be venerated, when the, if that person has that stubborn and obstinate and arrogant attitude, that generates the unwholesome karma that can lead to rebirth in a bad destination. And when they come back to the human state, then wherever they are reborn, they can be low-born. So this is the way that leads to low birth, namely one is obstinate and arrogant and does not honor those who should be honored. Okay, then we come to the converse case. Somebody is not obstinate and arrogant. He pays homage to one who should receive homage and so on. As a result of that action, he can be reborn in a good destination in the heavenly world, but if instead he comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is of high birth. Okay, this is the area of the particular passage that I'm finding somewhat problematic, because we have here, particularly against the Indian social context, the division of society into at least four main social classes or castes. you know, the main four social classes would be the Brahmin, using the Buddhist sequence, the Kshatriyas and Brahmins. Those are considered the high castes. Then the Vaishyas, the Kshatriyas are the administrators, the rulers, the political aristocrats. The Vaishyas are the business class, financiers, the landowners. So we could call this the middle class. And then there is the fourth class, which might have even been the majority, which are the Shudras, the menial class, the workers and the servants. And then, even below the Shudras are those who are outside the class system, what are called the outcasts. So those are, the lowest of those outside the class system are the outcasts, even those whose touch is who are considered untouchable and who are living in utter poverty, despised and condemned by those in the other social classes. And so, if one says that, this being humble and respectful then becomes the cause, the karmic cause for rebirth into high families, whereas being obstinate and arrogant is the cause for rebirth into the low families, that is, as a Shudra or outside the class system, outside the caste system, then it seems one is giving a karmic justification for the caste system. And yet, we always say that the Buddha rejected the Hindu explanation of the class system or caste system is determined by karma. It seems very problematic to me. Maybe you could please take the microphone.
In the sutta, though, the Buddha isn't saying that you get reborn in a good destination when you honor and respect people in a higher caste than them. It says the good effects, come to one who honors and respects and reveres one who should be honored, respected, and revered.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily somebody, anybody who's in a higher
caste. Oh, yeah, no. I'm not speaking with reference to that. Speaking with reference to is the condition in which he's reborn when he comes back to the human world. That is, when you go, it's about 8 lines down in paragraph 16, if instead he comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is highborn. And then the opposite of that is in paragraph 15, but if instead he comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is lowborn. And so this is making a distinction of against the backdrop of the Indian class system, of the division of the social classes into high birth and low birth, birth into prestigious families and into insignificant families.
But I think it is more pleasant to be born into one of the higher castes, right? I think that's what he's referring to.
Yeah, it's certainly more pleasant, but doesn't it seem to be giving a karmic justification for the class system?
Wait, one at a time.
I think Edwin, Robbie.
But the Buddha was born in a highborn. He was rich. And yet he chose to go, caste. The Buddha chose to go outcast, otherwise he would not.
Well, you see, even though the ascetics, the shamanas, were outside the caste system, but they were not outcast in the sense in which the chandalas or the scavengers would be considered garbage collectors and the toilet cleaners, the latrine cleaners would be considered, and the chattel ground workers, the cremation ground workers would be considered outcasts.
But would it be a person that has a small humble and has a lot less, have a better chance to practice than a person that has a lot or rich? Isn't that a chance to actually be more, or what do you call it, consumed with sins, and sensual desire because of so much money? I mean, you see rich people, they're not really happy a lot of times. And yet you see poor people that actually are very, very happy.
I actually found that to be the case. So not the really miserably poor people, but people who are living in very humble conditions. What I could observe, well, in Sri Lanka, perhaps even in this country, of course, people want to be secure economically, and so they'll have a lot of complaints, but they sometimes often have an inner happiness that one doesn't see in the rich, with the rich people. In fact, a little insight, information that I gleaned, when I was living in Sri Lanka, sometimes we would go on alms round, especially when we were staying in Colombo, to the houses. And sort of the inner knowledge that we had was, don't go to the houses of the rich people. If you go there, they come out and they'll give like a spoon of rice or a couple of bananas. Really, I'm not exaggerating, and congratulate themselves. But we thought were the best houses to go to, in case any of you get to eat one. I would call lower middle class, sort of like the humble village level people, even if they're living in the city, because they have strong devotion to the Buddha Dharma, and they're very generous, naturally very generous. But you can be like, don't tell you. And Richard, yeah. Oh, okay, Ravi and Richard. Yeah.
Siddhartha was a born a prince, so technically his caste was royalty.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So that doesn't change, because caste system, I believe, is from birth. But today in the world, one thing, you have the class system. The millionaires will be there, the poor
people. Yeah, yeah.
So this, at that time, the jobs went from father to son.
Yeah.
So you look at a class system which most people are against, because you can't better yourself in that system.
Yeah. But now when Siddhartha or Gautama became a mendicant, then, and this is true in throughout India, when you become a mendicant, a shramana, or a sannyasi, you give up your caste status.
I don't see this as the Buddha giving karmic justification to the caste. I just see it as him just making an observation and just saying, well...
Well, it's not a justification, but it's giving an explanation. It seems to be giving an explanation.
Yeah. If you read it, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, he's always accepted anyone as a sangha.
Oh, I mean, that is true. Yeah.
He didn't really discriminate.
There's no justification for the class system. And within the monastic order itself, the Buddha accepted, not only did he accept everybody, but whoever joins has to give up their class status.
Right.
And we even have cases of outcasts, people from the outcasts who become arhats, and then they become more spiritually prestigious than people from the Brahmin class who remain worldlings. Okay, I want to take Richard's question then, but I have to go through and finish the sutta. We'll have a discussion period after lunch.
No, but I have to just say this.
Yes.
This afternoon, you're showing a movie. I think this afternoon.
I'm showing a movie.
Yes, a movie in the library, Monk with a Camera.
2:00.
Is it today?
2:00.
2:00
today. Oh, it's
today. And it's exactly what we're talking about. This Nicholas Vreeland, very wealthy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And becomes a Tibetan monk and lives in...
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, what he's done.
You've seen the movie.
Yeah. Love it. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah, I think that the doctrine is one thing, but the social use is another.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that what's here is an arsenal for social control. Mm. That is, if you say that there's anyone who's lower caste who complains about anything, there's truculent in anyone. whoever gets angry at someone is told, well, this is why you're lower caste. You know, and you're going to be lower caste in your next life, too. And meanwhile, the upper caste are given this passive praise that says, well, because you're modest and you revere the right people and all of that, that's why you're on top. You know, and so no matter how arrogant they appear, you know, it's discounted because there's supposed to be this prior proof that they're good, that their past lives have to have been good. Right? So it's a means of manipulating societies here. Also, I don't know what evidence there is that this is not a demonstration of Hindus, of upper caste Hindus recapturing Buddhism after the Buddha's death, as I believe Nagarjuna. I mean, Nagarjuna was born a Brahmin, and the doctrines that he has are, he's inserting Hindu doctrines into Buddhism. I think the same thing is happening here. You know, by the way,
I think this merits further discussion, but I want to finish the sutta because I actually heard the bell ring or the blocks sound. So let's bring this up later, and we'll just go through there a couple of paragraphs left. Okay, now we come to paragraph 17. So this is, we have a case of a man or woman who doesn't visit an ascetic or a Brahmin and ask what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, blameable, blameless, what should be cultivated, not cultivated, what leads to suffering, what leads to happiness. And then because of performing such action, that is not visiting the ascetic or Brahmin, when they come back to the human state, then whenever they are reborn, they are stupid. So the stupidity, the commentary says, doesn't come simply from the fact that they're not visiting the ascetic or Brahmin, but from the fact that they're not getting information about what is wholesome and unwholesome. And so you have to come regularly to the class. Okay. And then, in contrast, some man or woman rings the gong while a monk or ascetic is teaching the Dhamma. Wherever he is reborn, that person is deaf. Okay. The contrary case, the person visits the ascetic or Brahmin, asks what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, and so on. And then because of performing and undertaking such action, they are reborn in a happy destiny. But when they come back to the human state, wherever they are reborn, they are wise. So this is the way that leads to wisdom, namely visiting an ascetic or Brahmin and asking such questions. Okay, so that takes us through the analysis, the Buddha's analysis of karma, and then comes a sort of just summary. So the Buddha says, the way that leads to short life makes people short live, the way that leads to long life makes people long live, and so on and so forth. The way that leads to stupidity makes people stupid. The way that leads to wisdom makes people wise. And I think also by stupidity here, we have to understand not like having a low IQ, inferior intellectual capacities, but basically being unwise, not having an understanding of how to act and conduct oneself. And then comes just a repetition of the general principle that beings are owners of their karma, heirs of their karma. It is their karma that distinguishes them as inferior and superior. And then when the Buddha completes the discourse, then the Subha, the young Brahmin, expresses his appreciation. And now he goes for refuge, and then goes for refuge to the Triple Gem. Okay, so this will take care of our explanation of the sutta. And we'll have a discussion period. Maybe we'll come back at 12:15 and then have a discussion about some of the problems that we can find in this sutta. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, bhutas or fear spirits, the nagas, the dragon spirits, and all beings. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Ekavata chalam hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Ekavata chalam hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Papagupadaya vichitato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya samino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibuddhim. Okay, next week we have a class. Next week is what, April 1st?
August 1st.
And the class will be on the greater discourse, or the longer discourse, on the analysis of karma, in which the Buddha will deal with what appear to be certain discrepancies or abnormalities or deviations in the working of karma. And maybe some of our problems will explain how this works. Okay, so we end with 3 half-bows for the people.
Out of context.